I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us and our work at www.deadsoulspodcast.com or over on Instagram by searching our name. As always, thank you for joining us.
The house looks just like the one next to it. And the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so unlucky.
With their 3 children. And something more.
Last night, do you remember when you woke up and you said you were here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you meet? Who's here?
TV people.
Something's funny going on here next door.
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances lately.
What kind of disturbances?
I don't know what hovers over this house.
Spielberg crosses a frightening new threshold into a world within our own. Its form is revealed.
What is it?
Its focus is clear. And the games are over. Poltergeist. It knows what scares you.
Now, if you're anything like me, you will have grown up being a huge fan of horror movies. Sure, some were cheaply made, formulaic schlock, but every now and again, you would have come across an absolute gem of a movie. One that was original, genuinely creepy, and outright terrifying. Some famed and celebrated movies from the 1970s and 1980s would go on to almost iconic status, creating famous characters, stories or tropes that are still revered to this very day. For me, one of these movies, one of the all-time horror greats, was the 1982 Steven Spielberg-produced Poltergeist. It was the first horror movie I can remember watching. I think I was like 4 or 5 when I first saw it. Way too young. But hey, it was the 80s, and I don't think many parents cared what kids watched back then. Mine sure didn't, at least. Watching a movie as powerful and spine-chilling as Poltergeist at such a young age probably impacted me more, way more, than it would have if I was the intended audience. Likely in equal measure positive as it was negative. I think I had nightmares for about 2 years following watching it. But I think Poltergeist as an original story still stands up today. In fact, when I threw the movie on a few months back, it still had the same effect on me. Minus the 2 years of nightmares, of course, and hopefully I won't wet the bed anytime soon. Anyway, standard fare when you talk about the movie Poltergeist is usually discussion about the so-called Poltergeist curse. With Poltergeist's huge box office success came a creepy mystique that the movie is actually shrouded in a real-life series of tragic and horrific events. Some folk came to speculate that a dark curse had swept over the production due to its somewhat evil subject nature. Throughout the 70s and 80s, quite a few movies seemed to have this lore about them, but Poltergeist was one that seemed to stick. Just to briefly cover what exactly happened to the movie for it to gain such a reputation. Well, peculiar and creepy legend surrounds the film franchise due to a number of unnerving incidents that happened during the production. The actress Jo Beth Williams, who played Diane Freeling, the mother to the family in the movie, claimed that writer and producer Steven Spielberg insisted on using actual human skeletons as props in an attempt to save money. Allegedly, these were cheaper than using plastic skeletons at the time. Those skeletons terrified the actress, and she stated that her reaction to them in the movie is real. She wasn't aware that they were the real deal until the camera started rolling. Williams claimed that she suffered horrific and chilling dreams for years following that shoot. To clarify, it wasn't actually Spielberg's cost-cutting idea to use real skeletons in this shot. It was Richard Edlund, the visual effects supervisor. But tomato, tomato. Additionally, in an effort to further disturb everyone on set, Will Sampson, the actor who played Taylor in Poltergeist 2, being a real-life Native American medicine man, performed an authentic exorcism after shooting Wrapped Up one night. Allegedly, this caused a great deal of unease amongst the crew and petrified the other cast members. Whether they believed in the ritual or not, and its surrounding lore, it unnerved many who claimed that there was an eerie feel over the shoot after that, with strange things happening every now and again. All this might just be people's minds playing tricks on them, given the subject of the movie that they were working on. But there are a few heavier elements to this so-called curse, which adds an element of speculative credence to the superstition. I'm speaking about the five members of the main cast, who all sadly died during or soon after the filming of the pictures. The majority of the fuel for the alleged curse fire stems from the demise of these cast members. Two of these tragic deaths in particular were highly unexpected and puzzling, which led many fans to speculate on the trilogy's eerie events. Possibly the most well-known death to occur is that of Heather O'Rourke, the child star of the franchise. O'Rourke played 5-year-old Carol Ann Freeling, the young focal point of the film series. Only 7 years old when the first Poltergeist film was released, O'Rourke captivated audience with her naturally platinum blonde hair, doll-like appearance, and big inquisitive eyes. Tragically, O'Rourke was misdiagnosed with Crohn's disease in 1987. The following year, she fell ill again, and her symptoms were casually attributed to be the flu by her doctor. Just a day later, she collapsed at her home, and paramedics who arrived at the scene deemed her condition serious enough that she needed to be rushed to the emergency room as soon as possible. While being airlifted to the community hospital in El Cajon, San Diego, O'Rourke suffered a significant cardiac arrest. Whilst doctors attempted to restart her heart, they discovered that she was suffering with intestinal stenosis and hurriedly attempted an operation to correct it. Whilst O'Rourke survived the emergency procedure, she would regrettably suffer another cardiac arrest while in the recovery room. This would prove to be fatal, and O'Rourke died at 14:43 p.m. on the 1st of February 1988. It was believed that she had been suffering from a congenital intestinal abnormality the whole time and was misdiagnosed Crohn's disease, a mistake that cost her her life. Julian Beck and Will Sampson. Well, these two other cast member deaths, while unfortunate, were not as unpredictable or mysterious as the first I mentioned, or last, which I will come to shortly. The role of the evil preacher Kane from Poltergeist 2 was played by Julian Beck. The teacher was a human embodiment of the beast, a demonic incarnation of a crazed 19th century leader of an apocalyptic cult who was now hell-bent, pun intended, on capturing the young Carol Ann. Amazing cinema. In 1983, Beck had been diagnosed with stomach cancer, which took his life soon after he finished work on the second installment of the series. It was his gaunt and somewhat skeletal appearance due to the cancer that actually won him the role in the first place. His chilling and creepy look was utterly perfect for the part, and naturally terrified children who were far too young to be watching the movie in the first place across the globe. Further tragedy struck in the same installment of the trilogy, after Willis Sampson, who played Taylor, the Native American shaman who would die following a heart and lung transplant in 1987, a year after filming completed on the movie. The procedure itself is incredibly complicated and has a very slim survival rate. Sampson was just 53 when he died, with the cause of death being post-operative kidney failure. Lou Perryman would be the fourth victim of the Poltergeist curse. Perryman played the character of Pugsley in the first Poltergeist movie. The Texas-born character actor appeared in a number of smaller roles in hits such as Boys Don't Cry, The Blues Brothers, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. He also worked as a crew member on the OG Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. Perryman was murdered in his Austin, Texas home on the 1st of April 2009. Seth Tatum, 26, had recently been released from prison for aggravated robbery. Following his release, it seemed he had stopped taking his medication, prescribed for bipolar disorder and polysubstance dependence, and added fuel to the psychological fire by going on a drinking binge for an extended period. Tatum confessed that he had killed Perryman with an axe and stolen his car. Perryman was not targeted specifically, and Tatum did not know who he was prior to being arrested for the crime. Tatum was convicted on February 1, 2011, after pleading guilty to all charges against him. He was sentenced to life in prison. On a little side note regarding the Poltergeist movie, actor Richard Lawson would narrowly avoid making our list. Lawson played one of the parapsychologists Ryan in the original movie, and he came very close to becoming another victim in March 1992. He was involved in a terrifying plane crash when US Air Flight 405 crashed into New York City's Flushing Bay en route to Cleveland, Ohio. 27 people would die in the crash, but Lawson, luckily, made it out alive. Perhaps the Grim Reaper or the Poltergeist curse missed its mark that day. The fifth person that was to suffer a tragic fate thanks to the Poltergeist curse, they say, is the subject of our episode tonight. The actress known as Dominique Dunn. For those of you listening who already have a fragile or waning belief in the American justice system, the rest of tonight's episode may not improve your situation. As usual, all links to reading materials, videos, and further research can be found on our website, deadsoulspodcast.com/justice. Dominique Dunn was 21 years old in 1981 when she met John Sweeney at a party. Sweeney was 7 years her senior, and the attraction was instant. Sadly, rather than leading to love and marriage, it led to violence and a brutal death. The petite Dominique, standing at just 5'1", was the daughter of acclaimed writer and movie producer Dominic Dunn, and sister to Alex Dunn and actor Griffin Dunn. Yes, he's the guy who got mauled by the beast in The American Werewolf in London. Dominique was also the niece to authors Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn, so she came from talent and a dynasty of art, literature, and influence. She seemed destined to make a name for herself in the celebrity-obsessed world of Los Angeles. By comparison, the athletic John Sweeney grew up in a small Pennsylvania coal mining town. He was the son of an alcoholic, and as he grew up, he would frequently watch his father beat and violently abuse his mother. Both were creative types, however. Dominique was an actress with a handful of roles under her belt, such as the television series Chips, Hill Street Blues, Heart to Heart, and of course the aforementioned movie Poltergeist. She spoke fluent Italian and adored animals. In the movie Poltergeist, she played the role of feisty and sassy teenage daughter to the Freeling family, Dana Freeling. John, meanwhile, was chef assistant to famous and renowned triple Michelin-starred chef Wolfgang Puck at the trendy and glamorous Marmaison restaurant on Melrose in LA. On the surface, the couple made a good match. Both loved Europe, animals, Dominique was very much an animal rescuer, and cooking. Dominique's diminutive size contrasted nicely to Sweeney's just over 6 foot frame. Both were extremely ambitious. Sweeney, however, desperately wanted to fit into the elegant world of Los Angeles and Hollywood glamour. He saw at Marmaison every night just how awe-inspiring, alluring, and enchanting the Hollywood lifestyle could be, and he coveted it badly. Dominique gave him an entry into that world, a taste of that life. The two moved into a rented house together within weeks of meeting. What should have been an exciting and romantic time quickly turned ugly for Dominique, however. She found out that Sweeney was no Prince Charming. He quickly began to display controlling and jealous behavior. They would regularly fight, and Dominique would leave their shared residence to return to her mother Lenny's home to escape Sweeney and his abuse. Unfortunately, after a few days apart, she would inevitably return, finding it difficult to resist Sweeney's charm. On August the 27th, 1982, after a particularly bitter argument, Sweeney grabbed Dominique's long, dark hair and yanked her so viciously that handfuls of it came out in clumps. A terrified Dominique ran to her mother's house, where Sweeney followed. He banged on the doors and windows, demanding to be let in. Lenny threatened to call the police, and Sweeney returned to their West Hollywood home to wait out Dominique. She would return a few days later. Barely a month later, on September the 26th, 1982, another argument erupted, and Sweeney grabbed Dominique by the throat, this time throwing her to the floor and climbing on top of her and beginning to strangle her. A friend who was staying with the couple at the time heard the assault and ran into the room where the actress was being attacked. Dominique told her friend that Sweeney had tried to kill her this time. Like any classic abuser, he denied it, gaslighting Dominique and suggesting that she come back to bed. She pretended to comply, but instead snuck out of the bathroom window. When Sweeney heard her car engine start up, he ran from the house and threw himself onto the hood of her car. He refused to get off, only recanting when Dominique briefly stopped and calmed down. But she soon escaped again, to her mother's and also friends' homes, where she called Sweeney and ended their relationship. She was firm and serious this time, and Sweeney knew it too. So he moved out. Shortly after he left, Dominique changed the locks and moved back into the property. I visited the house at 8723 Wrangley Avenue recently, and like most homes in Los Angeles, it seems small on the outside, but it's much larger when you go inside. It has that TARDIS effect. It's sprawled backwards and has another building at the bottom of the rear garden. It has had some work done to it since 81, when Dominique lived there, but structurally it remains the same. The street it's on, Wrangley Avenue, is kind of dark and foreboding, I felt. Considering that it's in Los Angeles, in the middle of the day when the sun is beating down, due to the overgrown foliage on the block, a lot of light is shaded out. It's kind of gloomy. But that's my personal taste, I guess. Anyway, despite the volatile nature of Dominique's personal life, her career was steaming full speed ahead. Her first role had been in a movie of the week in 1979, and by 1981, when she met John Sweeney, she had added several other television movies and some popular television programs of the day to her resume, as I previously mentioned. In 1981, when Steven Spielberg's classic ghost tale Poltergeist came along, her friends and family all knew that this was it for Dominique. Her star was about to rise. Just prior to filming her parts for Poltergeist, she filmed a memorable guest role on the hugely popular television series Hill Street Blues, in which she played a teenage girl who was abused by her mother. The day before Dominique arrived to shoot her scenes, Sweeney gave her a savage beating that resulted in cuts and bruises on Dominique's body and face. Showing up on set with a bruised face, the makeup department could take a break that day, not needing to add a lot of makeup to Dominique to make her look like an assault victim. In fact, the bruises seen on her face in the episode were real. You can check this episode out on YouTube and see Sweeney's brutal handiwork for yourself. If you head over to deadsoulspodcast.com/justice, we have the full episode there for you to view. As previously mentioned, we have left a link to the episode for further reading material and research for you to check out there too. By the time she finally broke off the relationship with Sweeney, Dominique had gotten a role in V, which was a mini-series about an alien invasion. On the evening of October 30th, 1982, she was rehearsing scenes for V with actor David Packer at her West Hollywood home when Sweeney showed up uninvited and demanded that she speak with him. After initially hesitating, she agreed and stepped outside to the front yard with Sweeney, leaving Packer alone inside. Packer offered to leave, but she requested that he stay. Dominique and Sweeney almost immediately began to loudly argue. Packer later said he heard slapping sounds, two screams, and then a thud. Frightened, he called the police, but only to be told that Dominique's home was out of their jurisdiction. He then called a friend, telling him that if he was found dead, John Sweeney had killed him. Packer left the home through a back door and found Sweeney near the driveway, kneeling over Dominique's body. Spotting Packer, Sweeney told him to call the police. Packer called them again and this time got through to the correct apartment. When the police arrived, Sweeney put his hands in the air and informed them that he had killed his girlfriend and had attempted to kill himself with pills. While Sweeney was hustled off to jail, Dominique was rushed off to Cedars-Sinai Hospital and placed on life support after her heart had stopped. Her father Dominic would later recall seeing his daughter in the hospital after doctors had screwed a bolt into her skull to relieve pressure on her brain caused by the strangulation. Her long, beautiful black hair, the same hair that Sweeney had grabbed in his fist to pull out, had been shaved off for the procedure. Her eyes were open and grotesquely enlarged from the assault. Tubes were everywhere, but the marks of John Sweeney's hands were still visible on her purpled and swollen, bruised neck. Dominique remained in a coma for the next 5 days, never regaining consciousness. Once the family had realized that there was no hope, they agreed with the doctors that the life support machines that were keeping her heart beating should be turned off. There was nothing more medically that could be done for her. Cedars-Sinai Hospital were keen to release a public statement shortly after Dominique's death and stated that they had not made the decision to turn off her life support, and that the decision was made by family members to do so. It was November the 4th, 1982, 19 days before her 23rd birthday. Even in death, Dominique would be kind and giving. Her kidneys were given to two patients at Cedars-Sinai awaiting transplant, and her heart was sent to a hospital in San Francisco and used on a patient there. John Sweeney had now graduated from an attempted murder charge to first-degree murder. He actually pled not guilty and was also charged with assault with intent to do great bodily harm, which resulted from the September 26th incident. He denied assaulting Dominique, instead claiming that he had been trying to prevent her from leaving their home and things got out of hand. John Sweeney's murder trial began on August of 1983. It was presided over by Judge Burton S. Katz, a man perhaps best known for being the Los Angeles deputy district attorney that successfully prosecuted Charles Manson, Bruce Davis, and Steve Grogan back in 1971 for the 1969 murders of musician Gary Hinman and ranch hand Donald Shorty Shea. Everything is connected. Katz's involvement in this trial would add insult to injury for the Dunn family, as we'll come to hear. The prosecution called a former girlfriend of Sweeney's by the name of Lillian Pierce in order to establish a history of his violent behavior. She and Sweeney had dated from 1977 until 1980. During the course of their relationship, she stated that she was assaulted by him on 10 occasions and was hospitalized twice for injuries stemming from his assaults. One hospitalization was for 4 days, another was for 6. During one of these assaults, she suffered a perforated eardrum and a collapsed lung. Later, she would sustain a broken nose from a Sweeney attack. She recounted how Sweeney would foam at the mouth when he lost control. She had seen him smash furniture and pictures. He'd even throw rocks at her when she tried to leave him. He was crazy, an animal which was out of control. Sweeney's attorney, Michael Adelson, went after Lillian Pierce as if she were the guilty party, however, in an oh-so-sympathetic lawyer method that's akin to slime. My personal opinion there, sorry. He accused Pierce of being a drunk and an addict, even suggesting that she had brought such violence upon herself and deserved what she got. His litigious attack was shameful and a tactic he followed when he attempted to besmirch Dominique's character too. Pierce testified without the presence of the jury, while Katz deliberated over whether to allow her as a witness in the first place. While she spoke, Sweeney became enraged, jumping to his feet and storming towards the door leading to the judge's chambers. He was eventually restrained by two bailiffs and four armed guards, and cried when he returned to his chair, where he was restrained and handcuffed. He apologized to Judge Katz, and Katz not only accepted his apology, but did so with a sympathetic comment, "We know what strain you're under, Mr. Sweeney. It's okay." Judge Katz, who appeared to have little sympathy for the victim and her family, and who continuously mispronounced Dominique's name in what the family felt was a purposeful act, apparently was sympathetic with the man who had killed her. A reporter from a local newspaper was in attendance and wrote about the incident. At Adelson's request, Katz would admonish this reporter for exaggerating the incident and issue a gag order to all further parties. This would be the first incident of Judge Katz bending over backwards for the defense. He would continuously prove to be far more solicitous of a murderer than the victim and her family in the case which would earn him infamy for his behavior. I won't go into the psychology behind his behavior in this trial and others where he showed empathy towards the offender, but needless to say, there's plenty to support a psychological analysis not in keeping for a man in his role and position. Judge Katz wasn't alone, however. Lawyer Michael Adelson had a particular bone to pick with the Dunn family. Lenny, who was suffering with multiple sclerosis, was in a wheelchair during the trial, and Adelson felt that her presence in the courtroom with her wheelchair would elicit sympathy from the jury and wanted her banned from the courtroom. Judge Katz, surprisingly, did not agree with the request, though. Seemed a fair decision from Katz, but he then agreed to a request from Adelson of an order that any emotional outburst by the Dunn family, including any crying, eye-rolling, and or making any type of exclamation, would result in them all being ejected from the courtroom. Even as small as an audible sigh from the family during evidence against their daughter would result in the family being banned from the courtroom and any further attendance. Adelson also tried to have Dominique's brother Griffin removed from the court for, as Adelson stated, having tears in his eyes. When the brothers changed seats while Sweeney was testifying in order to be in his line of sight, Adelson angrily tried to get the brothers removed from the courtroom. This instance was denied, but there was a clear display of anger towards the Dunn family, and it wasn't clear why. Adelson requested that Judge Katz rule Pierce's testimony inadmissible in court as it was, quote, prejudicial against Sweeney. Judge Katz actually granted the request, agreeing with Adelson. The courtroom was gobsmacked. Judge Katz's action meant that the jury would not hear of John Sweeney's violent history and outbursts until after the trial. He was not portrayed with an accurate and truthful depiction to the jury, and none of his violence or anger was allowed to be heard by them from the witnesses. Judge Katz also refused to allow Dominique's mother Lenny and Dominique's friends to testify about the abuse that Dominique suffered at Sweeney's hands. The judge actually considered their testimony to be hearsay and was from a, quote, point of bias, he said. Unbelievably, even more bizarre events and rulings were to come in the trial. On August the 29th, Adelson moved that Katz should rule that there was insufficient evidence to try Sweeney on the charge of first-degree murder, as there was no evidence of predetermination or deliberation. Judge Katz again granted the motion in favour of the offender, thus taking the first-degree murder charge off the table and allowing the jury to deliberate only on manslaughter or second-degree murder. This decision, along with not allowing Lillian Price, Lenny Dunn or Dominique's friends to testify, effectively dismantled the prosecution's case and should never have been allowed in a free and democratic court. Hashtag my opinion. Sweeney took the stand in his own defense and claimed that he and Dominique had reconciled and that he had meant her no harm on October the 30th, 1982. He stated they planned on moving back in together and had discussed getting married and having children the day of Dominique's death. According to Sweeney, Dominique had suddenly changed her mind, flipped with rage for no reason, and told him that she had lied to him about reconciling and had intentionally led him on. He, quote, just exploded and lunged towards her, unquote, but claimed to have no recollection of attacking her until he was on top of her with his hands around her neck, and she was not breathing. He stated he attempted to revive her by walking her around, but she fell over. He also made it an attempt at CPR, he claims, which he says made Dominique vomit and then caused him to vomit too. At that point, he ran into the house and consumed two bottles of pills in an attempt to kill himself too, a less than successful venture it seems. He then lay in the driveway next to Dominique after pulling her tongue out of her throat, which was something he said that he had done for his epileptic father, once. Adelson claimed Sweeney was in fact a hero, that his actions proved that Sweeney did not act with malice and had in fact acted in the heat of passion provoked by Dominique. Adelson continued that Dominique was the vicious attacker and he was the innocent, timid partner who just loved her and tried to save her. Dominique's family and friends were outraged. They disputed that the couple had reconciled and said that Sweeney had gone to her home on October the 30th in an attempt to get her to change her mind because he had firmly told him their breakup was permanent. The police also disputed Sweeney's version of events, as there was no evidence he had consumed any pills, and they found him to be calm and collected at the murder scene. There was no vomit at the crime scene, and the witness, David Packer, stated that Sweeney had not attempted CPR at all. Packer also stated that at no point did Sweeney enter the house or consume any pills during the event. The first police officer at the scene recalled Sweeney telling him, quote, "Man, I blew it. I killed her. I didn't think I choked her that hard, but I don't know. I just kept on choking her. I just lost my temper and blew it again." Unquote. To further dispute John Sweeney's testimony, and in direct contradiction to his claim of heat of passion, the medical examiner testified that Dominique had been strangled for between 4 and 6 minutes. "A prolonged period of anger did this," the examiner said. It was more than enough time for Sweeney to regain his composure and his control, and also plenty of time for him to look into her eyes as he killed her. Yet despite all of this, Judge Katz had determined there was not sufficient evidence to try John Sweeney for first-degree murder. The jury deliberated for 8 days, returning with a verdict on September the 21st, 1983. John Sweeney was acquitted of second-degree murder and found guilty of voluntary manslaughter, a much lesser charge. He was also convicted of misdemeanor assault for the September 26, 1982 attack on Dominique. It mattered little to the Dunn family, whose wounds were reopened with a verdict. Michael Adelson, ever the professional, was gleeful at the verdict. In an act of supreme grossness, he even began calling for Sweeney to get probation. Judge Katz did not grant it, but the damage had been done to his own character, to Dominique's loved ones, and to American justice. Outrage extended beyond the Dunn's family and the courtroom. A victims' rights group called Victims for Victims, established by actress Teresa Saldana, protested the verdict by staging a march outside the courthouse. Media outlets debated the outcome of the trial, directing harsh criticism towards Judge Katz. "This isn't a trial of outrage that had grown over time. This was outrage the moment, the second that it happened." On November the 7th, 1983, John Sweeney was sentenced to the maximum, 6 years in prison for the death of Dominique Dunn, plus an additional 6 months for the misdemeanor assault charge. During the sentencing, Judge Katz criticized the jury for handing down a sentence which he had basically guided them towards. He stated that Dominique's death was, quote, a case, pure and simple, of murder. Murder with malice, unquote. Such a statement does make you wonder that if that was the case, why did he toss first-degree murder out as a charge in good conscience? It also poses the question, was Judge Katz influenced by the protests and negative media? Had he changed his way of thinking, or was he trying to redeem himself, or maybe just save his image or reputation? Many possibilities that I guess we will never know for sure. The jury foreman said that Judge Katz's comment was, quote, a cheap shot, unquote. He went on that if the jury had heard all the evidence, including the hidden testimony and forensics removed from the trial by Katz, they would have convicted Sweeney of murder in the first degree, no doubt about it. Certainly not manslaughter. The foreman would also say that the judge's instructions to the jury were incomprehensible. Four times while deliberating, the jury asked for clarification on the instruction given to them by the judge. Judge Katz would only say the answers were in the instructions. He would provide no further clarity or information, and he refused to engage any further with the trial jury. At the time, the jury was deadlocked. John Sweeney was sent to a medium security prison in California to serve out his sentence. In September of 1986, after serving just 3 years of his 6-year sentence, Sweeney was paroled. 3 months later, he was hired as head chef at the upscale The Chronicle restaurant in Santa Monica. Upon finding out where he was working, Dominique's brother Griffin and her mother, Lenny, handed out flyers to the restaurant's patrons that said simply, quote, the food you will eat tonight was cooked by the hands that killed Dominique Dunn, unquote. The flyers had the desired effect. Sweeney was fired from his job almost immediately, and he moved away from Los Angeles. In the mid-1990s, Dominique Dunn was contacted by a Florida doctor who, after reading Dunn's article on his daughter's murder in Vanity Fair magazine, worried that his own daughter was engaged to Dominique's killer. His name was John Sweeney. He was a chef, and it turned out he was the same man who murdered Dominique's daughter. Griffin Dunn contacted the woman to try and convince her to call off her engagement and get away from Sweeney. John Sweeney subsequently accused the Dunns of harassment and changed his name to John Maurer. It was rumored that Sweeney, now Maurer, had relocated to the Pacific Northwest. With this news, Dominique Dunn initially hired a private investigator by the name of Anthony Pelicano to have Maurer followed for a time. But after he learned that the man had relocated to the Pacific Northwest, Dominique Dunn decided that he did not want to devote the rest of his life and his energy to the man who killed his daughter. Following the virulent opinions on how he handled the case and being voted the fourth worst judge to sit on the bench in Los Angeles, Judge Burton S. Katz transferred to juvenile court in Sylmar, Los Angeles. He wrote a book on the problems with the justice system, as well as becoming a commentator and writer for MSNBC and Time Warner. He is now retired from the bench, but provides private arbitration and mediation services. Dominique's older brother Griffin carved out a successful career for himself in Hollywood, acting in television and film before branching out into producing and directing. He was nominated for Academy Award in 2005 for his short film Duke of Groove. Ellen Lenny Dunn founded Justice for Homicide Victims, a victims' rights organization. Her work on behalf of victims' rights was honored by President George W. Bush at the White House in 1989. She fought a long battle with multiple cirrhosis and sadly died on January the 9th, 1997, at her home in Arizona. Justice for Homicide Victims remains active to this day. Dominique Dunn, Dominique's father, returned to New York after the trial. While in Los Angeles attending the trial, he drove around town in his daughter's convertible blue VW Bug. He later recalled keeping a pair of her sunglasses in his pocket during the trial to give him strength. Following the trial, he continued his writing career. He wrote a heartbreaking piece for Vanity Fair, which I will post a link to on our website. It describes the emotional stranglehold his daughter's murder and resulting trial put on his family. It's an incredibly moving piece, and I highly recommend giving some time to read it through. Dominic wrote multiple best-selling novels too, including one of his biggest hits, which focused on the O.J. Simpson case. He was a constant presence and support at the side of the Brown and Goldman families in the courtroom during the murder trial of O.J. Simpson. He most of all knew what it felt like to watch a loved one's killer not receive the justice that they deserve. He remained very much an investigative journalist until he passed on August 26, 2009. He was 83. John Sweeney, the man who killed Dominique Dunn, is now legally named John Patrick Maurer. He is now the manager of a high-end retirement community in California. His exact location, address, name of the company he worked for, and a lot more personal items of information are available online, but I'm choosing not to reveal them in this podcast episode. The greatest tragedy of this story is, of course, the death of Dominique Dunn. Only 22 years of age, she had her entire life ahead of her, and it promised to be a positive one. Dominique's professional options seemed limitless, and she was very much on the path which she most desired. John Sweeney had killed Dominique Dunn and received the legal equivalent to a slap on the wrist. Sweeney has never apologized to the Dunn family or expressed remorse publicly for doing so. When I am in Los Angeles, I often think about Dominique and this case. The city reminds me of it for some reason. I am sad for her. I'm sad for her family. She fell in love with the wrong person and paid for it with her life. Her family then had to suffer the injustice of a crooked trial in a system that couldn't care less. Dominique's funeral was held on November 6, 1982, at the Good Shepherd Church in Beverly Hills. A friend of hers said that it appeared as if a casting call had gone out to Hollywood. There were so many in attendance. People, her friend said, that Dominique had touched and who mourned her loss were all there. She was buried at Westwood Memorial Park, Section D, Lot 189, if you'd like to pay your respects. She is located not far away from the grave of family friend Natalie Wood. She died 6 years prior to her Poltergeist co-star Heather O'Rourke, who would also make Westwood Memorial Park her final resting place. Dominique's grave marker states, quote, "Dominique Dunn, beloved daughter and sister, loved by all," unquote. An extremely fitting epitaph. Should you wish to read more about this subject, please visit our website, www.deadsoulspodcast.com/justice.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.